it's Mountain Edition. All the news from the Roaring Fork Valley coming at you in the next half hour. I'm Kristen Kay, here with Allison Bechtesh. And Allison, my favorite piece of mail showed up in my mailbox just yesterday.
Oh my God, I think me too. Wait, what's yours? Was it money?
That's a good guess. But no, no one sent me money. It was actually my ballot for the election coming up in a few weeks. And we do have some election news this week.
Yeah, we have stories about a local ballot initiative that Colorado Mountain College is bringing to voters.
And no news is actually the news for Colorado state initiatives because there are none this year.
Also, we've been watching in shock those devastating fires in California. And we'll talk to a fire expert about how wildfires are changing because of the influence of humans.
For the record, a fire expert, really cool job. Okay, all that and more coming up next on Mountain Edition. Allison, let's start off today with the upcoming school board election for the Aspen School District. You've talked in depth with all five of the candidates who are running for three open seats. Side note, those full profiles are up on our website now. People can listen to extended interviews with all five candidates. There's a chart there showing their rankings on different issues. So people should definitely go there and check it out. But we have you here. So can you just summarize for us what are some big issues that you're hearing about in this election?
The way the candidates are spread out, what's happening is we have kind of a steady as she goes team and maybe it's time to shake things up team, because every incumbent is running and they would say, everyone agrees that the big thing is teachers. How do we pay them more? How do we get a more defined salary schedule? So whether or not that means a raise, it means I know if I do these credit hours, I can get more money, stuff like that. Usually it's a ballot initiative for like raising tax money or something. That's a big part of what the school board does is finances. That's actually not really one of the campaign issues this year, because we've seen that so frequently recently that the finances at the school are doing relatively great.
So let's talk about the candidates. Why are they running? What sets each of them apart from the others?
We got a good view of this at a candidate forum that was hosted at the high school last week. And there's more similarities than differences. They all have kids who are in the system or who have gone through the system. So they're all very invested in making sure the Aspen School District is the cream of the crop. I think the view of how to do that and if we're doing a good job on that now is where they set themselves apart.
So the thing about school board elections is that not everybody feels invested. Not everyone has kids in the school or will have kids in the school. But why should people feel invested? Why does this matter to our community?
That's a great point, Kristen. And I've even talked to people who didn't know that they got a vote for school board members because they don't utilize that service, essentially. But anyone who lives in the district, and it's a larger district than just Aspen or Snowmass. You know, it's one of the more bigger encompassing districts, voting districts that we have in this community, is going to have those five names on the ballot. So it is something to think about. Who do I want running the school system? As I said, it does affect taxes. These five people are the people who will be coming to you for money. They already have your sales tax and your property tax. That's higher because of the school district. And so if a cost of living is something that's a concern to you in this community, then that's a huge portion of where our taxes are going. But also things like this teacher retention and teacher salary. I mean, those people are our community, right? And a lot of them don't live in the Aspen School District voting area. So those of us who do need to take into account, do we want those long-term permanent teachers to be part of our community? What does it mean to have an educated young population in our community, and how does that affect things? So it does have a big impact. And of course, voting is important no matter what.
That's right. Moving on to other news from the week. Today, WeCycle will ask local governments for another year of funding. And the organization thinks e-bikes could be a solution to the Valley's heavy traffic. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy reports.
Mirta Mallory is executive director of the Bike Share program. She says e-bikes have the potential to get more cars off busy roads.
WeCycle is very interested in integrating e-bikes into its fleet to help facilitate the access from the farther outside areas of the urban growth boundary, such as the ABC and Burlingame and Buttermilk.
But that's not likely to happen next summer. There are policy kinks that need clarifying before an e-bike share becomes a reality. Colorado law now allows e-bikes on pedestrian and bike paths, unless local governments choose otherwise. Pitkin County still bans any motorized bikes on its trails, including the Upper Valley portion of the Rio Grande Trail, but other jurisdictions allow them. WeCycle presents to the Elected Officials Transportation Committee today. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
Allison, would you ride an e-bike?
You know, I'll try anything that will keep me from exercising.
Well, if I did, I'm afraid I might need an ambulance. And speaking of emergencies, yesterday the Eagle County Regional Airport held an emergency response drill. This happens once every 3 years. In a prepared scenario, 80 volunteers littered the runway, all with fake injuries. First responders then had to react. Wyatt Oram reports.
The plane supposedly landed at the end of the runway, then crashed through a fence. No plane was actually involved. Instead, participants rode to the end of the runway on buses. They had their faces painted with fake blood. Some even had on what's called moulage, fake wounds like a broken bone or an impalement that can be worn over clothing. Each had a card with their particular injury, which they then acted out. Jody Doney is the air service coordinator for the airport. She says some volunteers played their roles with gusto.
It was kind of fun. Got everyone ready for Halloween, that's for sure.
A formal evaluation of how the first responders performed is underway. Doney says during the winter months, the Eagle County Regional Airport is one of the busiest in the state. Wyatt Orm, Aspen Public Radio News.
This is such a fun story for me. There's a great photo from that emergency response drill on our website now. You have to see it. It's a close-up of a fake rubber bloody hand.
Just in time for Halloween. Let's go to the state capitol next. November election ballots were mailed to voters across Colorado this week.
And as Benta Berkland reports, there's no statewide ballot question this year.
Local issues, including tax and education questions, will dominate the off-year election. Voting will take place in all but six counties. Colorado Secretary of State Wayne Williams says many counties have adopted new equipment that allows the county to verify electronic votes after an election.
So that's an important security issue, particularly when you look at concerns of hacking or other issues.
Williams expects low voter turnout compared to presidential election years, which have the highest. Next year is the governor's race. Williams says that's the second busiest election. I'm Benta Berkland.
A lot of money is being raised for next year's gubernatorial race in Colorado.
Democratic candidates have raised more money than Republicans. Again, Benta Berkland.
Combined, Democrats have raised $3.6 million. Former state senator Michael Johnston was the first to enter the race and has brought in $1.5 million, followed by 2nd District Congressman Jared Polis with about $700,000. Eric Walker is a spokesman for the Colorado Democratic Party.
That's usually an indication of enthusiasm, and that tracks with what we're seeing nationwide, where Democrats are very upset with the direction of the country under President Trump and the unified control.
On the GOP side, Arapahoe District Attorney George Brockler and Doug Robinson, an investment banker and Mitt Romney's nephew, each raised close to $300,000. More than a dozen candidates in both parties are seeking to replace Governor John Hickenlooper, who is term limited in 2018. I'm Benta Berkland at the state capitol.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Allison Bechtesh.
And I'm Kristen Kay. And Allison, obviously, if people are listening to Mountain Edition, they want to stay in the know about local news, right?
Definitely. And they can also stay on top of what's happening with Aspen Public Radio and throughout the community by liking our Facebook page and other social media channels.
On our Facebook page, you can interact with our station through comments on our posts and by messaging us directly.
You can also go there for breaking news and other important updates on what's happening in the Valley and statewide. Every once in a while, a cute puppy photo.
Or a bloody rubber hand.
Yes.
If that's your thing. Check it out by searching Aspen Public Radio on Facebook.
So ski season's coming up. When we look out our windows here at Aspen Public Radio, we can see a little bit of white at the top of Aspen Mountain.
I think all the ski swaps are the sure sign for me that everyone's getting ready.
Well, it turns out not everyone, maybe. Millennials aren't skiing or snowboarding as much as their parents. It's a problem for ski areas. Wyatt Orm has the story about how the Aspen Skiing Company is trying to attract people in their 20s and 30s.
Student loans and career demands are among myriad reasons why millennials are being outskied by their parents. But their parents were also skiing more when they were in their 20s and 30s. Jeff Hanley, the director of public relations for SkiCo, says one thing to keep in mind about millennials is they like variety and adventure, thus the Mountain Collective Pass, where customers get 2 days at over a dozen resorts across the U.S. and Canada. Aspen Snowmass is one. Another way of luring millennials, Hanley says, is the mountain's new marketing campaign, the Aspen Way. It emphasizes social justice. The campaign wasn't meant to target millennials. Nonetheless, young people are drawn to companies with values they identify with. Wyatt Orme, Aspen Public Radio News.
Several environmental watchdog groups, including Carbondale-based Wilderness Workshop, are formally protesting the sale of oil and gas leases on public lands in northwest Colorado. They say energy development in this area would threaten the Colorado River. Environment reporter Elizabeth Stewart-Severy is here in the studio to talk through the details. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Kristen.
So what's the conflict here? Why are there protests?
Well, the BLM sells leases to companies that want to drill for oil and gas on their lands. And in this case, environmental groups say there wasn't enough consideration of environmental concerns, especially threats to the Colorado River.
Okay, what are those concerns?
All right, so this area in western Garfield and Mesa counties is rich in natural gas. So we're talking about hydraulic fracturing or fracking operations. Fracking uses a lot of water, and the wells in the Colorado River Valley would pull that water from the Colorado, which is essential to the entire western U.S. and Mexico. So this river provides water to 40 million people, and it's at risk already from a whole bunch of different issues, including rising temperatures, diversions, and dams. And basically, Wilderness Workshop and other environmental groups, including the Sierra Club and the Center for Biological Diversity, say that further depleting that would be detrimental to the entire western U.S. They also say that development on these lands would put endangered fish and plant species at risk.
So how do those leases get issued in the first place?
Well, the agency identifies lands that are appropriate for energy development. And really, most BLM land is available for oil and gas drilling if the resources are there. The default is kind of to allowing this kind of development on those lands, unless there's a specific reason that there shouldn't be. So that would be like if it's a state wildlife area, special recreation area, or something like that. These particular leases are up for sale in December, and they include 28 parcels totaling over 27,000 acres in Garfield and Mesa counties.
What's the BLM's response to the protest?
Well, there's no comment on the specific protest because it hasn't been resolved. But I talked with David Boyd from the BLM, and he says that the agency goes through environmental analysis and what's called a resource management plan. In this case, that was completed in 2015. He also told me that the BLM can manage for concerns that are specific to one area, like danger to plant species or to fish, after the leases are issued, as the oil and gas companies go through the approval process to actually start drilling. So the agency will consider the protest and then decide if they want to put off the sale until the issue is resolved, or they might decide to dismiss the protest altogether, or they can go ahead with the lease sale, but essentially tell the companies that they have to wait to start drilling until the protest issue is resolved.
Okay, thank you, Elizabeth.
You bet.
That's Elizabeth Stewart-Severy, our environment reporter, discussing conservation groups protesting the sale of oil and gas leases on Colorado public lands.
Colorado Mountain College wants to make up for diminishing revenue by tinkering with property taxes. Voters have the final say this November. Wyatt Orme has more.
On ballot question 4B, CMC is essentially asking to adjust property taxes as it sees fit. State law limits the portion of property tax that can be collected from homeowners. Because of population growth on the Front Range, residential property taxes have dropped statewide. This means that this year, CMC didn't have $2 million it thought it would. Should the measure pass in November, the college will be able to make up this revenue. The college has 4 campuses in Garfield County. Wyatt Orme, Aspen Public Radio News.
On January 2, 2016, armed protesters seized the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Oregon. Tonight, the Wheeler Opera House will screen a documentary about that incident, No Man's Land. Claire Woodcock has more.
The film shows the motivations behind the occupation and the effect it had on the surrounding community. Ammon and Ryan Bundy led a group of anti-government extremists in response to the prison sentences of 2 Oregon cattle ranchers convicted of federal land arson.
When we start worrying about who our neighbors are, that's an underlying fear that people shouldn't have to deal with.
This is filmmaker David Byers' directorial debut. funded by a Mountain Film Commitment Grant. Byers examines the events as extremist groups continue to emerge across the United States. The screening starts at 6:30 p.m. Claire Woodcock, Edless Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
Jennifer Balch is the director of CU Boulder's Earth Lab. Her research focuses on the human impacts of the fire season and the expansion of the wildfire territory.
She spoke to Elizabeth Stewart-Severy by phone earlier this week.
Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, thanks for having me.
In California right now, we have wildfires that are tearing through neighborhoods and destroying homes, forcing people to evacuate. I think for many of us, when we hear the term wildfire, we think of natural environments, but the images from these fires does not match with that. Does that illustrate that people across the West should be prepared for wildfires to start coming closer to home?
Yeah, we build in flammable places, and particularly in the West, where many of our ecosystems are adapted to fire, we're essentially putting homes in the path of fire. At the same time, people are also bringing fire wherever they go. Over a two-decade period, we've looked at the number of wildfires that were started by people across the country, and it's over 84%.
We've seen tons of wildfires across the West this summer, but not as many in Colorado. Can you speak to some of the areas of concern in Colorado or what is happening in our local fire season this year?
Yeah, in Colorado, we experienced a little over 60,000 acres of wildfires. And when you compare that to Montana, which experienced over 1 million acres of wildfires this year, Colorado was spared. And part of the reason why that is because California, Oregon, Montana experienced some incredibly dry and hot weather conditions this summer and then leading into the fall. There's three things that fire needs: an ignition source, fuel to burn, and dry conditions. And so the perfect combination for fire is when you have a wet period followed by a dry period.
Now, we know that ecosystems across the West actually need fire to be healthy, and I'm wondering how we find that balance living in fire-prone areas while also allowing these natural cycles to happen.
Yeah, that is the question. 9% of the U.S. is this intermix between wild areas and urban areas, and that's projected to double by 2030. The consequence of that is that we do have to reckon with how those homes and how people are vulnerable. It's impossible to remove fire from the landscape, but we can better manage it, and we can better build into these ecosystems. There's lots of things that we can do to reduce the flammability of homes by using materials that are less flammable. We can focus on the arrangement of communities and building in fire breaks using roads. There's lots of things that we can do to make communities more firewise.
Jennifer, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Yeah, have a great day.
Jennifer Balch studies wildfire at CU Boulder.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bechtesh.
And I'm Kristen Kay. In other local news this week, Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper is joining forces with an organization started by Aspen Mayor Steve Scadron.
The Roaring Fork Valley's health insurance costs are already the highest in the state, and those numbers could rise due to a presidential order signed last week.
And the Denver region submitted its bid for Amazon's second headquarters on Monday.
You can read about all of those stories and more news on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Colorado's conservation policies earned a top ranking among Western states. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy has more.
The Denver-based Center for Western Priorities ranked state policies in three categories. Colorado earned top marks for responsible energy development and outdoor recreation, and was second best to Montana in the public lands category. Colorado far outpaced other Western states in the energy rankings. The center cited the state's methane waste laws as a model for others to follow. Colorado also requires transparent reporting of chemicals used in hydraulic fracturing. Governor John Hickenlooper set goals this past summer for increasing renewable energy and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Colorado also scored well for its focus on outdoor recreation, a multi-billion dollar industry. But the state has room for growth in allowing access to public lands, especially along rivers and streams. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
Aspen Snowmass has had its busiest September ever.
For the second year in a row, the Aspen Snowmass Resort experienced more visitors in September than it did in June. Labor Day weekend was the busiest of the entire summer. Nearly 97% of hotel rooms were booked throughout Aspen and Snowmass Village. A report this week from Stay Aspen Snowmass President Bill Tomsich shows that the increased visitor numbers even occurred midweek. More people booked their stays ahead of time. The average room rate for the month was $317 in Aspen, $175 in Snowmass Village. October is also on track to log higher bookings than last year, but Tomsich says that November will be its typical quiet time in the valley.
Last week, construction workers outside Carbondale were digging a natural gas pipeline. They accidentally chopped through a fiber optic cable buried in the ground. Thousands in the valley suddenly lost phone and internet service. To learn more about what happened and why, we turn to our reporter Wyatt Orm. So how bad was this?
Pitkin County's manager, John Peacock, told me that the severed cable affected 15,000 people in the valley. But it seems like where you were and who your providers are were the biggest variables in how affected you were by this. The cable that was cut belonged to CenturyLink, and it was connected to some local cell towers, but not all. So someone might not have had service in Basalt and then driven down to Glenwood Springs and been just fine. Also, as far as the provider goes, I saw comments on Facebook made by people in Carbondale saying, you know, my cell phone isn't working and my internet at work is down, but my internet at home is good. But interestingly enough, it also affected landlines. Aspen Valley Hospital couldn't make or get calls or emails from outside of the hospital.
And that brings up the real issue. The real issue wasn't that people couldn't, like, get on Facebook.
Right.
It was that people might not have been able to get help in case of an emergency.
Exactly. The Pitkin County Dispatch says that it was able to receive calls. But, of course, the real worry is that people weren't going to have service to make 911 calls. Brett Loeb, who's the communications director at Pitkin County's dispatch, he told me that 85% of people in the valley rely exclusively on their cell phones. So the Pitkin County Emergency Communications, they put stuff up on social media. They send out Pitkin Alerts, which is an email system, and also a text notification system. Loeb told me that they basically tried to reach out in every way possible. They sent out emergency broadcasts to TV and radio stations, but the reality is this is not a good situation. We are very dependent on these devices, and when they stop working, we become extremely vulnerable.
So if we remember back to 2015, another cable was cut, and a lot of people lost service. So what steps are being taken in order to make sure this doesn't happen again?
The answer is redundancy infrastructure. You need a plan B. You know, if your main quarterback gets injured, you need a second string quarterback to step in and take his place. CenturyLink told me in a statement that they had redundancy circuits in place for the cable that was cut. But if that's true, then obviously the system still failed. In any case, Pitkin County is taking steps to build out their own redundancy network. They have all these radio towers around, and they're installing a system where internet service can basically bop around these different radio towers, and that is the way that they're going to sort of protect themselves from issues like this in the future.
Okay, thank you, Wyatt.
You're welcome.
This month, a local utility is offering discounts for energy-saving water tanks for livestock.
Wait, I have to stop you there.
Like for them to drink, not like a little hot tub for cows.
Right. Elizabeth Stewart Severy has more.
Cattle and other livestock need water all winter, even when it's freezing outside. And as Brandon Jones with Garfield Clean Energy explains, it's not always easy.
Livestock owners are either paying an arm and a leg on their electric bill to heat water outdoors in our cold winter climates, or they're forced to break up ice with a sledgehammer or an ice pick and shovel it out of tanks that are unheated and insulated.
Holy Cross Electric is offering discounts on passive solar water tanks, which capture solar energy to keep water from freezing. Other utilities, including XL Energy, Glenwood Springs Electric, and Aspen Electric, are offering rebates. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
The Roaring Fork School District got its test results back from when students took the PSAT and SAT last spring. Math scores are keeping up with the state average.
Reading and writing, however, is not. Wyatt Orm reports.
These results are concerning to Rob Stein. He's the district's superintendent. Colorado's standardized tests changed 2 years ago, so it's hard to spot trends just yet. But the SAT scores show the district has work to do to get students prepared for college. They're behind state averages in many cases. About 30% of students were in the lowest category for the PSAT's reading and writing portion. Stein says one factor is the district's high concentration of students still learning English. Wyatt Orm, Aspen Public Radio News.
Benjamin Teitelbaum is an assistant professor of ethnomusicology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He spent much of his career studying music in white nationalist movements.
Unfortunately, this is particularly relevant because there's a speech tonight by white supremacist Richard Spencer at the University of Florida campus. I think they've declared a state of emergency even to get ready for this.
Yeah, these stories about the resurgence of white supremacists aren't going away. Arts reporter Claire Woodcock spoke with Teitelbaum about the cultural changes as these groups get more and more national attention.
We are talking about a political cause that, since World War II, essentially, has even relished the identity of being the most offensive, the most marginalized, the most discredited political cause in the West. At least that's how they see themselves. And for a lot of people, that was probably, you know, the most appealing thing, the most attractive thing, that you could really upset polite society if you're a white nationalist. You can upset it in ways that hardly anything else can. It's hard to underestimate the importance of the change when you have a cause that has viewed itself in those terms for so long. All of a sudden, we get to 2015, 2016, 2017, and you have Steve Bannon, let's say, a well-known, influential national figure inside of the White House. It ties in with music in part because this is, I'd say, the chief manifestation of feeling empowered and the same impetuses that say, well, we don't need to futz around with music anymore. We can actually conduct real politics and traffic in the realms of policy rather than expressive culture.
How has music played a role in prompting the white nationalist movement's wills to normalize?
When these activists start to use less stigmatized forms of music, less alienating forms of music, that to me is an expression, a reflection of their will to blend in, that they see opportunities, that if they change themselves, they could win greater numbers of sympathizers. But the actual engines of mainstreaming have centered more around media, in fact. It's been Twitter, Facebook. That has helped more than anything. Granted, YouTube, you know, can function as a social media platform, but it's also one of the places where a lot of music making today is going on. And the so-called American alt-right has factions, have groups that invest a lot of time in producing music that is produced and consumed for YouTube channels. We think first and foremost of a sort of a techno style of music called Fashwave. Tends to not have lyrics, but is traded and watched a lot on YouTube. Also some rap music with automated voices to sort of preserve the anonymity of the artist. That's being distributed.
That was Benjamin Teitelbaum, an assistant professor of ethnomusicology at the University of Colorado Boulder, discussing his research into the music of white nationalist movements. I'm Claire Woodcock at the Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
That's all for this week's Mountain Edition. I'm Allison Bektesh.
And I'm Kristen Kay. To hear this show again or to find more news from the Roaring Fork Valley, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Thanks for listening. We're going to make Mountain Edition your favorite show.
That's right.
It's a production of Aspen Public Radio News.